It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
As one of the crew of this faster-than-light spaceship of the future, sharing their curiosity to know the unknown, their tension, their readiness for inconceivable adventures.
Sir, we're being radar scanned.
United Planets cruiser C-57D, J.J. Adams commanding. Who are you?
Morbius of the Bellerophon.
Well, Dr. Morbius, my orders are to survey the situation on Altair 4.
Commander, if you step down on this planet, I warn you that I cannot be answerable for the safety of your ship or your crew.
When you reach the forbidden planet, you will meet Dr. Morbius, played by Walter Pidgeon. The doctor is sole owner of this fabulous world. Anne Francis is his alluring daughter, Alta, who has never seen a young man till she meets Commander Adams, played by talented Leslie Nielsen.
Not in.
Didn't bring my bathing suit.
What's a bathing suit?
Oh, murder.
You will meet a charming character in The Robot, able to produce on order 10 tons of lead or a slinky evening gown. Always at your service.
You must be the loveliest, softest thing you've ever made for me. And fit in all the right places, with lots and lots of star sapphires.
Star sapphires take a week to crystallize properly. Would diamond or emeralds do?
You explore all the wonders of a vanished civilization. You travel deep down into the heart of the forbidden planet to discover the incredible marvels of this lost genius race. These magnificent scenes in striking Eastman color stagger the imagination.
20 miles. Look down, gentlemen. Are you afraid? 7,800 leveled.
Yet the wonders of the planet Altair 4 conceal a strange and evil force, unknown, irresistible.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spataro, and as is always the case, really is always the case now, on the other side of this internet tin can is Mr. Sean Whalen. What's happening, Sean?
It is terrific to be here today.
It's terrific to talk to you today. So I'm going to just give a little background. I've been trying to see movies that I hear are classics, that I've heard reputations about, that I've for different reasons I've wanted to see for years and years and years, but never got around to it. And I've been posting a lot of them on the Is It Yours Facebook page, saying that I'm watching this, I'm watching that. And, I'm very happy with getting these movies done. So one of the movies I recently watched was Forbidden Planet from 1956. And Sean and I were talking and we were saying, what movie should we do? And Sean said, "Oh, Forbidden Planet you just watched. That sounds interesting. I've never gotten a chance to see that either." So that's what we're doing today. And I'm going to say that Forbidden Planet, this is, again, the first time I've ever seen it, but I've heard of its reputation for years and years and years. And I sat down and watched it, and I watched it purely for the entertainment value because that's the way I was watching it. And since Sean and I decided to cover it, I watched it a second time just to have a little bit more of a critical view of it. So the thing about this movie is, I'm just going to throw out, I think from a cinematic fan point of view, it's good. It's a very good movie to have seen because it's got a historical presence to it that it's been a big influence on science fiction movies over the years. I would say it was entertaining, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, but it had very much a feeling of a 1960s science fiction TV show. Specifically, it felt to me like I was watching one of the early Star Trek episodes, as far as the content and the special effects and all of that. It felt like the Man Trap to me, very much so. And it's interesting from that perspective. So, again, a movie I thought was very cool to see from a historical perspective. And entertaining in its own right, but not something that you look at now in 2025 and say, oh, this is something I need to see on the big screen because of the special effects and the science fiction and all that. It was definitely a more cerebral type movie, which links it to Star Trek and the complaints they actually had about Star Trek when it first went on the air. Given that as my preamble, what did you think, Sean?
So Case Western Reserve Bias has the something called the Cinematheque, and it is a basically a nonprofit that will re-release movies. This is one that I would like to see at the Cinematheque just because they tend to throw it on the big screen, but it's that type of thing. It's not one that I would re-release necessarily into theaters now, and you'd go that route with it. It'd be nice to see in that type of environment. My background with this is very similar to yours. Growing up, I remember going to the Ground Round restaurant and seeing the Flash Gordon cereals. And the Ground Round, for anybody who's never been at that restaurant chain, what they did was you could throw popcorn on the floor and peanuts on the floor, as you were eating them, the peanut shells, you'd throw them on the floor. So it was always, you'd walk in and everything was this crunchy sound.
Pre-peanut allergy.
That's exactly right. Very much so pre-peanut allergy. It wasn't a big thing. But in the background, they always ran old movies, those old Three Stooges and Flash Gordon serials and things like that with music playing, but no sound from the actual film itself. So I got very into pulpy serials. Forbidden Planet, I've seen so many visual images of over the years, especially Robbie the Robot, which is very iconic. I realized when you were looking for something for this one, I haven't actually seen this movie. So I kind of like to see it. And I was a big Lost in Space fan. So it gave me a Lost in Space vibe, to your point about TV shows, which clearly was influenced by this as well. So when you were saying Star Trek, I'm like, yes, absolutely old Star Trek. I also would throw in their old Lost in Space as well, because it was clearly influenced by this some level.
Well, sure, Robbie the Robot.
Exactly. So when I was first watching this one, I'm going to be honest, like the first maybe 15, 20 minutes in, I'm like, oh, I don't know if I even like this. then it hit me. The story is one of those where there's like a gradual build that's going on and you're trying to figure out what this film's trying to be, at least for me. And then it hit at a certain point in time and it was like, oh, wow, I thought it was going to be this and now it's that. And then it's then partway through the film, all of a sudden it turns into something completely different. While at the same time keeping the character development that was there. There's a lot to love about this one. It is one, I think your disclaimer at the beginning of sorts is really valid. This is something where you're not going to be blown away by the special effects or things like that because of the fact of it's 1956. But one of the things I think that works for it is the set design and the way it used, because I think the Star Trek series is a valid comparison, because there's times when you look at certain Star Trek sets and you're like, that's a really cool set. Like, I actually want to run around on that set. This had a lot of visual sets that I actually would love to today, if they were somehow intact somewhere, I would love to run around on those sets, like actually get into what it's like to, you know, how far did they go with the set design? Because I actually really liked the visual styling as it was, as the story progressed and we got to see much more of this world.
Interestingly, when I read up a little bit about this, all of it was filmed indoors. They were all matte paintings and, you know, especially, you know, just whatever kind of set design they could do. And I think it won some sort of I think it won an Academy Award for set design or whatever that award would be. But, you know, it was definitely, to me, that was also reminiscent of Star Trek. Because, you know, a lot of the matte paintings felt very much like what we saw on Star Trek. And that is meant, frankly, as a compliment, because I always thought the matte paintings on Star Trek were very well done. You know, sometimes you can tell that it's a matte painting, but it's not, it never looked bad. It just looked at, you know, if you were trying to deconstruct it in your mind, you could figure out that there was a painting in the background. And again, the story now, just to touch on that, I always heard, and I guess it holds up, that this is loosely based on Shakespeare's play, The Tempest, which I have zero familiarity with other than the name The Tempest. But that is apparently something where they go somewhere and there's either some sort of magical element or something like that that's going on in the background. And so it's almost a Shakespeare, at least from what I can pick up, some sort of like there's a mystery involved as to how things are developing and what's going on. And I think that's what this builds on. And it's interesting the way it goes. And again, to me, it really felt, I felt a very, very tight connection to the Mantrap, the Star Trek episode, because they're going to investigate this world where this plant, you know, where a ship had gone, and they're, you know, they're on a mission to check on it, and the person who they're going to see is saying, no, we don't need you here. And then it turns out that there's, you know, a mystery and a deadly mystery going on. So I don't want to give away too much, because I think if somebody wants to see this again, and I would recommend it if you have an interest in cinematic history. That's really my caveat on that. Or if you want to see what would now be considered somewhat of a light science fiction movie. I think it's still, again, I think thought it was entertaining in its own right. It's just that it's apparently very, very influential on what came after it, but we've seen what came after it a lot. So that's the reason why it's not as groundbreaking now as it was in 1956.
There's a lot of interesting cast members in this, too, that I do think it's interesting to see them maybe in different roles than you would have seen before. And I'm going to point out Leslie Nielsen, just an example. Later in life, Leslie Nielsen was very much known for comedy. And this is a different role for Leslie. I mean, especially being the lead in it as the ship captain or ship commander. In this process, you get to see him in a much more serious role, and where he is kind of the suave, almost Captain Kirk role. It's funny, as you're mentioning Star Trek, I am kind of putting him, he's kind of in the Captain Kirk role.
I'm going to interrupt you just for a moment, Sean, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but I had that thought as I was watching it, was, you know, okay, if they had done Star Trek 10 years earlier, would Leslie Nielsen have fit the Captain Kirk role? And my thought came to, I thought he fit more with what we got from Jeffrey Hunter as Captain Pike.
Oh, yes. Yes. I'm sorry. When I say Captain Kirk role, I'm more saying as the captain of the ship, the lead of the ship. I'm not saying that he's the Kirk archetype. I like your comparison way better. I think he is much more Captain Pike than Kirk as far as in personality and the way he carries himself. That's incredibly accurate.
And you talk about the actors in this, and I it's funny because I first really got to know Leslie Nielsen when he was doing the TV show Police Squad. And it got to the point where if he was on the screen, my mouth would start going into a smile and I was ready to laugh as soon as I saw him. So, you know, the Police Squad movies, the Naked Gun movies, the, Airplane, I got a big kick out of all of those. But that was the way I knew him. And then I remember reviewing one of the movies that we covered on here in The Poseidon Adventure, where he played the ship's captain before he was known for comedy. And I found it hard to totally take him serious because I had so pigeonholed him into the comedy role. But, you know, up until Airplane, he was a serious actor and he was on a lot of, movies like this, or, you know, episodes of Columbo and things like that, where, you know, he was a serious actor. So it was interesting to see him in this. The only other one who I recognized right off the bat was Earl Holloman as Cook. And it's interesting to see him because he was much younger than what I'm used to seeing him in. I remember him more from the 70s. So it was interesting to see him as the young buck on this particular show, or movie rather. The name who jumped out at me, who I did not recognize at all, was Richard Anderson, who I know from the $6 Million Man.
Yes.
Or from the Night Strangler. Those are the two that I really know him from, but I did not recognize him when I was watching this.
No, I recognized also Warren Stevens. I've seen Warren Stevens in other film before, who he played the Doc. So I recognized him immediately as somebody who I'd seen in other films. But you're right, Earl Holloman, my gosh, he was almost ageless throughout his career because no matter what touch point, you know it's him. Whereas Richard Anderson, I didn't realize he was in it until I was looking at the cast afterwards. And I'm like, Oscar Goldman was in this. I'm like, oh, cool.
Yeah, I had the same exact reaction. You know, the only thing I'm just thinking, like, I know Earl Holloman. I think he was on, was it Policewoman? He played like the supporting role on that show, and that was the main thing I remembered him from the 70s. And then in the 60s, I know him from The Sons of Katie Elder, a John Wayne movie where he played one of John Wayne's three brothers, which was an interesting casting just to, you know, go off track a little bit, because one of the other brothers was Dean Martin. And it's just interesting to have John Wayne and Dean Martin playing brothers. But anyway, that was a fun movie if anybody's interested in Westerns. Walter Pidgeon is somebody who I heard of, and I'm sure I've seen him in things. I know he was in How Green Was My Valley, which I saw it many, many years ago, but I don't have any specific recollection of seeing him in anything. I thought he was awesome in this. I thought he really was the, you know, the MVP of this movie, in my opinion. Just the way he played the character, so strict and to the point, and, you know, I just thought he was great.
He got top billing in the end credits too, which I noticed as we were there going through them, and it was it was him, then Leslie Nielsen, which I think is totally valid on this one, because I think you need to get that role. Because he needs to be this enigma, and there needs to be a certain likability to him, while at the same time you have to – he takes you through the full emotional gambit, because there's points in time in the film where you're ready to shake him. And there's other points in time where he's incredibly intriguing and compelling and interesting. Like, you want to follow him around. You want to know what his discoveries were, because he really is kind of like the narrator to your journey. You're following along with him. He's kind of like the Burt Lives of this movie at certain points, until he's not. And there's a turn at a certain point where you start to question him. And I think it's when the daughter first appears, it starts to poke some like holes into, okay, this guy's really interesting and intriguing, but I am never going to close my eyes around him. But I feel like I've always got to keep one eye open and watching what he's doing.
It's an interesting portrayal, and I think it required a layered portrayal, because there's mm-hmm. the mystery that goes on in the movie. And as the movie progresses, you know, the Leslie Nielsen character, John Commander Adams, realizes what's going on. And you as the viewer realize what's going on. And it directly involves Dr. Morbius, played by Walter Pidgeon. And the thing about it is, Dr. Morbius doesn't know. It involves him, but he doesn't know. It involves him and his, you know, his unconscious mind and what's going on, that he doesn't even know that it's happening. So he's got to play this as the mystery character, but he's not in on the mystery. He's not in on the secret. He thinks he's totally innocent in all of this. So it required, I think, a layered performance, and I thought he did that. He's both sympathetic and the villain at the same time.
Yeah, 1,000%. And I think that's critical, because there's never a point in time where I'm thinking, man, he's totally bad. And I thought that was compelling in this, because usually it's very, very black and white. You know, at a certain point, you're like supposed to hate him. I never felt that with him in this. I felt like he was this man who came across this just monumental discovery that drastically affected him and set him on this path where he is the catalyst for a lot of the things that are happening, but he does not consciously do that. He has to come to the conclusion that he's a part of all this. And I'm trying to skirt a line here of not saying too much with regards to that, but I want to address the fact that that is an interesting role with him, as far as he's somebody you almost want to blame, and yet you can defend him at the same time. And I love films like that, where I still liked him at the end of the movie. You know, and there was something pretty critical about that.
Well, you if you're going to blame him, you're going to blame mm-hmm. him for his apparent denial of what's going on, because yes. the clues are there and he should have seen what's going on. He should have understood what's going on, but he's living in denial because he's trying to live this idyllic life and on this planet where everything has been provided for him.
During the film, one of the things that he's doing is constantly talking about the advancements and his own advancement. There comes a point in time where he got so advanced that he kind of lost touch with being grounded. And I think that plays into why his denial is kind of a thing. Sometimes you learn you can't be objective. If you think you're perfect, or you think you're so advanced and above others that you can't see your faults and flaws or question yourself. And I think he'd lost the ability to question himself. And I thought that's where the film got really compelling for me, was you kept mentioning the layers with him, and I could not agree more. That casting was so brilliant, because none of it felt fake. It all felt authentic. It felt like a man really going on this journey. And I found myself sometimes characters like that are more of the scientist of the film almost become unrelatable, because they go too far with the scientific side that you can't get connected with them. I found myself being fully connected to this guy, feeling he was very, very human. And I think that's a victory of the film, because I think other science fiction films could learn from the balance of, yes, he is this higher person now, but you still want to make him relatable. so that way we can latch on to him and learn something from him. And I thought it was that he was a great cast.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's easy to sit here and pick it apart and say, oh, you need to do this, you need to do that, but actually doing it on the screen and having it be believable that he's really thinking these things, not so easy. And he's also got to have an imperious nature about him on top of all of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like I said, I believe it was a very layered performance, and I thought he did it masterfully. So another interesting performance, and another, I think, difficult performance was Anne Francis as Altera. You know, she's got to be playing her part as really a very naive person. Again, almost a little bit of denial going on, because she's had a chance to be educated. She's had a chance to learn what things are, but she clearly is, you know, she's clearly grown up in a very, very protected environment. So, you know, she's got to play it as a sexy, smart, but very, very innocent and naive person. And I think that's a difficult balance. And I thought she did pretty well with it.
The one thing I thought that was interesting with this one, and I give him a lot of credit for this, because I think for 1956, it's pretty cutting edge. She wasn't the typical damsel in distress. And I think the naive piece was very well handled. It's not because of the fact that, like, she's incapable. It's because of the sheltering that you mentioned. And the movie makes it very, very clear. She hasn't interacted with people other than her father, hasn't interacted with people. You know, it's been her father and Robbie for most of her life development, and animals that happen to be there that are seem to be tamed when they're around her. You know, I mean, she's got at one point in time, got like a tiger that, like, she can just put her hand up and he's kind of like, oh, yeah, this is great. Nice to see you, purr.
Until later when he attacks. Yeah.
Right, which was a great scene because of the fact that I think as she changed, she became almost unrecognizable to him. But I like that these guys are attracted to her because she's a very beautiful actress. But these guys are attracted to her, and I like that it's not all this. She is this dumb. You're right, she's naive, and I love the way that you put that. But you also mentioned that she's smart, and that is very well played in the script. She is an intelligent person. There's a lot of intelligent dialogue going on between her and the people that she's interacting with, even though she's interacting with certain things the first time. Even kissing, the way it was handled in the film, she does not understand the emotional piece behind it because she did not – that's a part of her development that didn't happen. So emotions do happen for her in this film, and we get to see them happen organically in the film. She played a very, very smart role because we got to see her make some life journey throughout all of this, where the love story, actually, I found myself rooting for her and her chosen partner as the story went on, because of the fact that I felt like it was handled in a way that made her a compelling character versus sometimes that screechy, annoying, which was sometimes a trope that was done back in the day way too much, damsel in distress. I found that she was just an incredibly rich and compelling character. This is a very smart script, and I think that part actually adds to why this is an interesting film.
So now big portion, apparently, of the budget was spent on Robbie the Robot. Mm-hmm. And he was considered groundbreaking at the time because generally a robot portrayed in a science fiction film before this would be a man, you know, I assume a man, maybe a young man because it's sometimes smaller, but in a tin can. You know, and that was it. Now this one, you know, was more complex. It's by today's standards, you look at it and think, oh, well, this thing could hardly move cleanly, and you know, wasn't going to do all that much. But by, again, 1956 standards, this was groundbreaking, and the robot was supposed to be, you know, incredibly strong, and it had all sorts of defensive or offensive capabilities. and, you know, was able to simulate things and create things. And it was, you know, a very complex character for someone who did not have, you know, much more than, you know, was basically a robot.
I still want one in my home. I mean, which is probably the victory of how much they did with this thing. It is so cool. I mean, granted, I agree with everything you're saying as far as like the practicality of the robots that were created in for like past sci-fi. Even, you know, robot from actually Robbie, I will say, has some legs up on the robot from Lost in Space. There's certain things that I think are a little more practical on Robbie than the robot from Lost in Space, who I adore. But I really, so much of Robbie, I think, goes back to, we were talking about Walter's portrayal of Dr. Morbius. I think his interactions with Robbie and talking about how Robbie is this functional assistant and security and all those kind of pieces, but also how smart the robot is. You can give this robot certain orders and it's got a directive. We go back to Star Trek with Prime Directive and that type of thing. Robbie has a certain directive as far as interacting with people that cannot be overcome in his programming. I really enjoyed seeing how much Robbie could do, but how much thought went into making Robbie this kind of safety net for technology back in the day. They really thought through Robbie as a fully realized concept, and Robbie was cool. Robbie was I liked any scene with Robbie. I actually liked how Robbie, to the point of the cook, Robbie and the cook had that great interaction around certain beverages. And I love that Robbie served this purpose of making people happy, trying to resolve certain things that Robbie was able just to functionally do. You could see how with the two of them living on this planet, how Robbie could be part of them sustaining a quote unquote kind of normal life because they had this resource.
And, you know, I'm as a geek, I'm forced to kind of connect things a little bit. And, you know, I started thinking to myself, well, you know, I know Asimov was famous for his science fiction writings on robots. And I remembered vaguely, yeah, he had developed the three laws of you know, robotics back in the, I think it was in the 40s, might have been in the 50s. But I just, you know, I felt the need to look it up. And his rules were: a robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Two, a robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. And three, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. And I think Robbie the robot fit Asimov's three rules of robotics. And I think that was, they had that in mind when this script was written. So I found that to be another interesting aspect of this. Anybody else in the cast who caught your eye?
No, I think a lot of the crew that were on the ship were meant to be like crew member number four and things like that, just to give you the sense of scope and scale and the fact that it was a working active ship. I think they highlighted, you know, we had the love triangle that was there, I think, which was a piece, which was, which character was that? Was that Lieutenant Farman? Was that the one that was the, where they were having the initial love triangle with Altera?
You know what? I got confused over which character was which a little bit on that. They had a kind of a double triangle because they had that, which was the romantic love triangle, but then they had the loyalty triangle with Dr. Morbius also, that she felt loyal to him, but she wanted to do what Captain Adams was bringing her to. So I thought that added to the complexity of the script.
And that was a lot of the early on stuff that was going on. The love triangle was kind of like the early part of the story. Before we even started getting into exploring the world itself and its depths, and because that's what, one of the things for anybody listening to this that is actually a character, the world does become a character as the film progresses. because the film hits a certain point where now all of a sudden we're exploring this world and there's an interesting backstory to it that leads to some of the problems that they're facing and solutions to it. And that's actually surprisingly, you're pretty well into the film before we start getting into those pieces. And I think it was a very good pacing, because by the time we got to that, I actually cared about all these characters, which was a strong, I think it was a strong way to tell the story and to have it unfold.
I think we need to talk about what were, in 1956, groundbreaking special effects. Mm-hmm. You know, there is, without giving away too much on it, there is the creature that's laying waste to people and apparently laid waste to the entire crew of Dr. Morbius's mission before they got there. And it is portrayed by basically putting electrical lines or electric looking lines in the shape of a beast. Looks to me like the shape of a bear. I don't know if that's exactly what they were going for, but that's what it looks like. But very, very vague and threatening. For the time, it was very cool. And I think you do have to watch this kind of thing with an understanding of, you know, they didn't have CGI and they didn't have the ability to just put something on the screen because they thought of it. And I think it was pretty creative to come up with it the way they did. And I thought it looked pretty threatening. And the way they portrayed it with the sound effects and the music, and we'll talk about the music in a moment. But I thought it was well done, again, watching it from the perspective of film history and saying, okay, in 1956, this is what they had to work with. And it's pretty darn creative as far as I was concerned.
They also saved that for later in the film. They used this invisibility portion of it, like it couldn't be seen. I thought earlier on, you know, where there were depressions in the ground and they were large, and they weren't like, you didn't see like a paw print or anything like that. It was just a large indentation in the ground, bending of stairs, things like that, that they did along the way, I thought were really, really clever. And led to when we did have that reveal that you're talking about, I felt like it meant something more, because you wanted at that point to see, what did this thing look like? Mm-hmm. You know, and even then, the way that they're doing with the electricity, I don't know that we ever get to see the full image of what it really looks like. I'm with you in this. It looks like a bear-like creature, maybe even a lion. Doesn't matter. It's the idea behind it is it's a monster. And it's huge. And where this monster comes from, it needs to have that kind of almost like what is it kind of quality to it. And I thought that was really effective. And we're seeing it, I think, because of the fact that it was fighting against this barrier that they had. So I don't know that it was supposed to be seen, but it was seen because of the fact that the electrical barrier was surrounding it and it was fighting against it. And I thought that was very clever, because I didn't feel like, oh my gosh, this doesn't hold up. I felt like it still stands up as like, wow, that's pretty cutting edge. I mean, that actually works. There wasn't a whole lot in this that I thought was cheesy special effects by today's standards, which says a lot by what they were doing at that era.
Yeah, again, groundbreaking for the time. No question at all about it. And it also had, I believe, the first ever kind of electronic musical score, which definitely it's, you know, to break it down, it's not something I would put on in the car while I'm driving. But for the purposes of the movie, which is really the purposes of the score, it set a mood. It set the futuristic feel. It set the scientific feel. It definitely enhanced what we were watching. And then at the points when there was something threatening going on, it enhanced that as well. So I thought the score, again, while not something I would listen to for pleasure, I thought it served a very good purpose for the movie.
Yeah. There's action and drama and certain pieces where you need to feel that. And I felt like there's nothing that pulled me out of that. I was guided through the emotional interactions it's supposed to have with this film.
And the movie was directed, just as a kind of a last thing, by Fred Wilcox. And it looks to me, I'm looking at his filmography, you know, he had Lassie Come Home, he had The Secret Garden. It looks to me like he was more or less a storyteller of stuff that, you know, not necessarily spectacle. Now, this movie has an element of spectacle to it, but I think the thing that makes it more watchable and more enjoyable is the fact that it's got the human aspect of it. So I think his history lends itself to showing that human aspect, the backgrounds of, the of, you know, Captain Adams and Dr. Morbius and Altera. I think that's really what holds this film together, and then you add the science fiction elements to it. So I thought he did a good job of balancing all of that in this film.
The only other thing I want to mention is the crew. I felt like they're Leslie Nielsen played a character that you could understand why people would be loyal to him, and I felt like there was more than one incident in this film where people needed to show their loyalty to the commander, and they did. And it felt believable. It felt true. It's strange to say that a lot of the characters felt like just crew member number two and crew member number three, but I felt like they felt like a crew. And there was, I think, the lead characters that were a part of that crew who interacted with him, they showed us enough of why they would respect this guy at times where you really needed them to in order for this story to feel like fully realized. Because this is a crew you can see following him and wanting him to succeed and believing in when he gave an order, they should follow that order. Even if they didn't always like it, they needed to follow it because there was something about him. And I thought that was something that was also well delivered in this, because it's a space mission where they've landed on this planet, and you got to feel that this crew at this point isn't ready to mutiny on him. And I thought that they captured that really well with the crew as well. And that has to do with the other leads that were interacting with him from the crew, that you get why when things start going where they do, why this crew will do what this man says in order to interact with what's going on around them and stay as cool headed as you can in that scenario. Agreed. That was pretty well developed.
I agree with you totally. I think that was a good portion of this. And again, I think that goes even, you know, I think you articulated it better. But I think it goes to what I was saying about him combining the human element with the science fiction aspect of the movie. And I think that was well portrayed in this. I would note that, you know, it said that, or it is in the Wikipedia page, that the film was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. So I think that goes to what we've talked about as far as the you know, historic aspect of this movie. Unless there's something else, I think we can rate this.
Yeah, I agree. I think I'm ready for this one too.
And I had a you know, I had to give this some serious thought because of the significance of it. From a filmmaking perspective, and then I have to balance that with the entertainment aspect of it and the spectacle and everything that's going on in this movie. And if you eliminate the historical cultural significance of this movie, I found it to be entertaining. I enjoyed watching it. I found it, you know, it was a movie length episode of Star Trek, a movie length good episode of Star Trek, in my opinion. So I think from a purely entertainment point of view, this is a Jaws 2 movie. This was entertaining and I enjoyed watching it. I think if you're a film historian, maybe you might rank it a little bit higher. I mean, I do enjoy the film history point of view, but I don't think I can rate it as a Jaws, but I think I'm good with it being a Jaws 2.
We couldn't agree more. And I was teetering on Jaws 1 for this one, but I was really finding when I was doing that, I was just giving it for the historical significance piece of it. So from a personal perspective, I think it's a Jaws 2. I will rewatch this film again. I liked it. I mean, it was very entertaining to your point, which I think is an important piece to this one. I think if you're looking for a film that really clearly had a lot of influence on science fiction, where you're going to enjoy watching it, this is one of those that I would highly recommend picking up. It's a very, very, very fun film. And I felt like about 15 minutes in, I really was invested in the movie. So it says a lot about that, with it being from 1956, going in cold, other than I knew of Robbie the Robot because he's iconic and has popped up in so many things. This is a film that I think you should definitely see. But I agree with your rating totally. I think it's a Jaws 2. I think it's one of those that is worth a view.
So just to go off the beaten path just slightly, but the way I'm coming across these movies, you know, I mentioned how I'm trying to watch movies that I've heard of and whatever, is every once in a while I go to turn the classic movies on my TV set, and I just start going through what's coming up. And when I see a title of a movie I've heard of frequently but have yet to ever see, I click for it to DVR it. And that's how I'm picking out a lot of these movies that I've been watching. That's how I picked out this one. And so far, it really hasn't let me down. There's been some that I've watched I thought, I don't know if this is as great as what they made it sound, but just the same, you know, I'm glad I saw basically everything I've seen as I've been doing this. So I'm going to continue to do that, and hopefully my wife won't get tired of me putting on these movies that she doesn't necessarily have interest in. Anyway, thank you everybody for listening. Thank you, Sean, for joining me again, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Bye-bye.
Hey, what's this dust coming?
We're being met.
Bosun.
Aye, aye, sir.
Hold the tractor.
Aye, aye, sir.
Quite a vehicle, huh? That driver must be a madman.
What driver?
Gentlemen, I am to transport you to the residence. If you do not speak English, I am at your disposal with 187 other languages, along with their various dialects and sub-tongues.
Colloquial English will do fine, thank you. This is no offense, but you are a robot, aren't you?
That is correct, sir. For your convenience, I am monitored to respond to the name Robbie.
Nice climate you have here. High oxygen content.
I rarely use it myself, sir. It promotes rust.
Hey, Doc, is it a male or a female?
In my case, sir, the question is totally without meaning. Will you get in, gentlemen?
Quinn, track this. If I blink red...
I'll bring the tractor in a hurry, sir.
Right.
Passengers will please fasten their seat belts.
After us like a mother.